Hello, everybody. This is Doug and Linda with Emotional Affair Journey, and today we are happy to have as guests Mona and Gary Shriver, and they are founders of Hope and Healing Ministries, which was started back in 1998, and it was founded by two couples brought together through their mutual counselor to support one another in their adultery recovery. And Gary and Mona Shriver are one of those couples. And Hope and Healing Ministries is a Christian-based support system devoted entirely to helping couples who have experienced the heartache of adultery. Mona and Gary are authors of the book Unfaithful, Hope and Healing After Infidelity, along with the Crisis Support Handbook, Adultery Recovery Resource Kit, and the Protecting Your Marriage Handbook. And they also are active in various support groups and hold weekend intensive support groups, I guess, a couple times a year at this point. For more information about Gary and Mona and the programs and services they offer, you can go to their website, which is www.hopeandhealing.us. Gary and Mona, did I miss anything there?
I think you did great. Thank you.
You rock, Doug.
Okay. All right. Well, welcome, by the way, and thank you so much for being with us here as we're going to discuss rebuilding trust after infidelity, okay. And we very much appreciate you being with us, and I know that in our own situation, rebuilding trust for Linda and myself has been, you know, pretty long and hard process, as I'm sure it was with you, and we just kind of wanted to talk today about and let our listeners know maybe a little bit about your story and your experiences with rebuilding trust after an affair. And I know that's a fairly loaded subject and everything, but Mona, as a betrayed spouse, I guess, how would you say you began your journey to trust again?
Very cautiously. I didn't know if we could, and I certainly didn't know how to do it. We just began. But the one thing I did know from the get-go was that I was not going to pretend to be healed, and I was not going to live in a marriage that wasn't real. It was either going to be healthy or it wasn't going to be. So I think that was the motivation that kept me on the track, along with some good Christian counseling and the Lord, of course. But,
sure.
I wasn't going to stop before we were really healed.
Mm-hmm. So you had the mindset right off the bat that that is what you were going to work for and work towards and set out on that path.
Right. But now there were a lot of bumps in that road because it's exhausting. It takes a long time. It's not pretty. And you lose hope.
Yeah.
You know, you get to where you think, well, this is never going to happen. Mm-hmm. So there were times, in fact, our roughest patch was about 10 months into our recovery, and I was done. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't going to happen. I was done. He was leaving. And
at her request.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Because of our counselor that we had an emergency meeting with, he was able to get us back on the path and starting that walk again.
You know, I think that when we talk about trust, I think one of the things that, if I can just chime in here, I think that so many people in the early stages, in that, you know, emotional tsunami stage, in the very beginning stages of adultery recovery, I think that they want to buy into the fact that, well, we just forgive and move on. Mm-hmm. We just forgive and forget and move on. And you can't do that. You know, so many people think, well, why not? You know, I mean, I've come home, I've, you know, confessed, and you know, now we're back on the same page. Well, you're not on the same page, because I think that the offender, you know, they've been living with this reality for all through the affair, but, you know, the spouse just sits there and, you know, has this bomb dropped on them at that one point. Well, so many people think that, well, you can just forgive and move on, but you can't. This is, and I think the best way to describe that is the trauma that a person goes through when they have had this bomb dropped on them. And I don't use that word lightly. This really is a trauma to the person, you know, to the relationship, of course, but also to that person that's had that. And it's on the order of losing a loved one, losing a child, or losing your spouse. That's how big a trauma this is to a person emotionally. And to think that they're just going to be able to just forget this and move on without talking about it, that's silly to even think that. Say that to a widow that just lost her husband of 40 years. Just say, you know, we're not going to talk about this anymore. We've grieved it for a week. We've grieved it for 2 weeks. Well, now we're just going to move on and never talk about it again. Wrong. That's not going to happen. So I think if the offending spouse can start realizing of what they have caused in their spouse by bringing home this, you know, revelation to them, and start to realize that you would never expect a person to come through it that fast, that this is going to become a journey that a couple will have to travel. And rebuilding trust is major part of that journey. And to think that that's going to happen overnight, it's not. It's going to be something that's going to take a long time to get through.
And I think
that's something we hear a lot on our blog, too. I'm sorry. But I was going to say, that's something we hear on our blog in the comments a lot, too, is that, you know, the cheating spouse just wants to, you know, confess and move on, and let's go on like it never happened, or you know, get over it already, that type of thing. And that's just simply not the case.
The sad part about that is that sometimes the experts we consult even encourage that.
Yeah, they do.
And so
they put a time limit on it.
They do.
Exactly. Yeah, you got 2 sessions to ask every question you're ever going to ask.
And then you're done. Don't bring it back.
What's that going to do to that person? All that person's going to do is going to obsess at that point. Mm-hmm. I got to ask everything I can. I've only got 2 weeks. Wrong. They need to have the freedom to ask any question they need for as long as they need to ask.
As they need to.
That's right.
Until they can process the enormity of the situation.
Right.
As we talked before, sometimes it's when you get the information, it is too difficult to handle it all.
Exactly.
So you only take little bits and pieces and you process that, and then you want to go and ask those same questions again so you can handle it.
Yep,
it takes a very long time to actually understand everything.
That's very true. If you comprehend the trauma that Gary referred to, and you know, we have enough scientific studies out there to recognize what happens biologically when the person's exposed to trauma. If you remember, you know, 911, you look at those faces, there's no affect. They are either over-emotional or under-emotional. Post-traumatic stress disorder is often a part of this whole thing.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And so, if you tell someone, if you time limit it, and you time limit while they're still in that traumatic state, it's impossible to do. You know, you need to get back in your right mind. You need to get on the grieving process path. And so we really, we give spouses, betrayed spouses, they determine what they need to know and when they need to know it. There is no time limit.
Right.
Period.
I still ask questions. It's been over 2 years.
Yeah, because you didn't even think about it.
That's right.
You know,
right.
You didn't know what questions to ask in the early stages.
And Linda,
you know,
given that freedom in the process, then you can relax in this. Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of offending spouses say, okay, I want it over. We want to move on. We want to do it right now. Ask your questions and get it done with. And when we move on, if you don't feel free to that, then like I said before, you're going to start to obsess. And you won't, and Linda won't have any peace. And so if you just buy into the fact that there's going to be questions, you're going to go down this path together, you're just going to be open, you're going to be transparently honest and all of that, and Linda has the freedom, Mona has the freedom to ask whatever they need to ask, whenever they need to ask, then you're going to have good days in this process.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because I think some people look at it and say, oh, my goodness, you're talking that long. Well, if it's going to be 2 years or a year of this, I'm out of here. Well, no, you just have to just know that it's a life journey like anything else. And as you travel this path, you're going to have good days, you're going to have bad days, and you know, it's going to be better. But just get it in the light. That's the important part.
I think what we try to tell others is that if the cheater is open to let the betrayed spouse, you know, ask the questions and they are patient, then we will settle down a little bit. We won't be so hyper, so stressed and insecure.
Right.
It's the way they're responding to us that's making us crazy.
Right. Well, and the other fear that you hear from the experts is, oh, you're going to have pictures in your mind you don't want that you can never get rid of. Well, that's true. But if I can't think through and process, do I really want to know this? then you're going to ask it because this is your last chance.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
If I know that I can take my time, think it through, and evaluate, do I really want or need the answer to this question, I don't have to ask it right now. There is no time limit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that gives me freedom to, for some people to say, you know, I don't need that detail.
Yeah.
And I think it also gives you the opportunity to ask questions that are important for your relationship rather than for the details about the affair.
Right.
Exactly.
You can ask questions that will be helpful to you and help you move on than asking what restaurant you went to or, you know, how often did you call or things like that.
Right. Exactly. It was really interesting. I happened to participate in a, it was a therapist continuing ed workshop, and I was able to attend that, and it was all on infidelity recovery, and they did some role play, and the role play, and they didn't know who I was or why I was there, but they put me in the position of the betrayed spouse with a counselor and the offending spouse, and my question was, what hotel? And the husband and the counselor were trying to convince me there was no need to know
that.
What hotel, because that was the expert's take on it. And so I thought, okay, I can play this game, no problem. And I remember, why do you need to know that? Why do you need to know that? And I was able to share with them, because when I drive down the road, it's not every hotel I see.
Right, that's true.
I can reduce it to one.
Yeah.
And the therapist that was playing the therapist, she said, okay, answer the question.
Yeah. She backed up.
She did.
Yeah, that is a great answer. And now I understand why you want to know, because it's not every restaurant. It's not every...
That's right.
Then you can actually just let it go after you
then
know.
You can. Then it's just, you know, every Clarion, and you avoid Clarions, or you reclaim Clarion, whatever it is. You know, there's
whatever you need to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the best illustrations I've ever seen, and it really is effects, is as the offended spouse is coming through this, it's like you've given them all these puzzle pieces, and they're trying to put together a puzzle.
And
they are. Safe again, they need to put this puzzle together, because during this whole period of the affair, there's no absolutes anymore. It's not life as we knew it, because there were lies. There were, you know. And so now you got all these pieces, and now you're saying, I got to put this together, because I think that really helps a person that's like the offender to understand what's going on in their brain. Is there's going to become a before, during, and after on all of this, which they're kind of rewriting their history. Well, the best illustration I ever heard is, you put out all these answers, all these puzzle pieces on a table, and if you're not willing to share, it's like you reached over and turned off the lights. Now this person has to put together this puzzle in the dark. They can't. So obviously, we need to be open and honest and transparent if they're ever going to trust us again.
And I think our imagination is probably worse than the reality.
Oh, yeah.
Right. For most people, it is.
Yeah, I remember hearing that in a group one night. And he said, you know, and she goes, he says, well, you know, you don't want to hear whatever it was, or I can't remember exactly what he said. And then she came back and she goes, do you believe, you think my imagination is any worse than reality?
Yeah.
What's going on in my head right now is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So deal with
it is.
Get it in the
light.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, when we were going through this, I had a spreadsheet and I documented their day, you know, by looking at the phone logs, trying to put it all together to understand it. And I mean, it was obsessive and time consuming, but I needed to do it.
You did.
Because I wasn't getting the answers. Yeah.
If you look at the trauma research that's been done, and no therapist will argue with this, the way to heal from a trauma is to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key. So, you know, it's really ironic that a lot of experts say, well, you don't need to understand the infidelity. You just need to work on the marriage. It's impossible. It doesn't work.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to make sense that you can just move on without understanding why it happened in the first place and what
you
need to do to fix, you know, fix things as you move forward. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, and I don't know if you guys see this, but we see it all the time. A couple that's been through some sort of infidelity, either, you know, whatever, in the earlier days of their marriage, and they did some work or didn't work at all, but followed that advice, the marriage never really heals. The trust
right.
is never reestablished. And then we see them again.
Right. And yeah. I think, you know, I've had people who write to me and say, you know, I need to get over it and I need to move on. I'm just being a victim. And I wrote back and said, I'm doing this right. I will know when it's time to forgive, when it's time to mm-hmm. trust, but I need to do it when I'm ready. And mm-hmm. I'm not, and we need to work on our marriage and make everything the way it should be before, you know.
Right. Right.
There is, and I think, as you said, 10 months seems to be a very common time because I think that the cheater wants it over with, is
right.
losing their patience.
Right.
And then the betrayed spouse becomes very frustrated with themselves mm-hmm. that they're not over it.
Right.
And that, and I think, you know.
And the fact that you're so weary from the battle at that point.
Right.
Because, you know, I mean, that adrenaline rush that I think is the offender that you get
right.
in the it wears stages
off.
Yeah, for that, you know, that damage control thing, it wears off.
It does. And you're dead.
Yeah. So now you're sitting there just totally weary. And then she asks the same question again, which for the last five times has put her in the fetal position, sitting in the dark for 4 days of depression. And now she asks the question again. And I go, why are you? Where before I could say, I understand the pain, and if we need to go there, we can go there. Well, you know what? After 15 times of this, you start to go, why do you need to ask this question
mm-hmm.
again? And then, and the thing I think that a lot of times the offenders don't really understand is the fact that as soon as I start to pull back, then she gets to the starts feeling insecure again,
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
she'll start to obsess again.
Right,
that's why
obsess.
It's so
yeah.
important. To be able to be there for them and just walk this path with them and totally, and it's a phrase I use, get behind their eyes. Truly try to see with empathy and compassion where they are, the pain that you've caused, walk this path with them, and they'll relax and they'll become secure. But, you know, it's not mm-hmm. without, it's a process, though. It's not a product. You don't just move on. You have to go walk the path.
Yeah.
And
look,
the other thing, if you understand the trauma and you remember to correlate it with the sudden death of a loved one, what happens mm-hmm. around 1 year?
Triggers, yeah.
Uh-huh.
There are all those
right.
normal triggers. In fact, mm-hmm. they're called anniversary reactions. And it's a normal part of the healing process when you're grieving. And so rather than thinking, oh, my gosh, we're never going to heal, you can look at a calendar and go, oh, okay,
yep.
this is playing a role in this. We can get through this. It's a bump in the road. It's not a permanent thing. It doesn't mean, it doesn't negate all the work we've done, and it doesn't take away any hope of healing.
Right.
It's just another phase.
It's adding normalcy to a very abnormal situation.
Mm-hmm.
If they can feel that, they can feel the hope in it. Yeah.
I think being aware that's going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you get into self-fulfilled prophecy. So I get real careful with that one. It's like, well, you know, in 3 weeks, you got your anniversary coming up. You talk about lighting the fuse to their bomb. Give me a break.
But it helps.
Yeah,
it
does.
Really helps if you anticipate and then you can plan something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And when they have it, you know, we can just be there with hope, you know, and just to say, you know, you – come on, this is normal. And then they
yeah,
go,
I think it's just knowing it's normal.
Yeah,
that's right.
Right.
That's
right.
That brings the hope. It really does.
Hey, Mona, I was wondering, and I know that Linda went through this too, and it really has to deal with when you know, the affair first came to light and everything, she really lost trust not only in me, but she lost trust in herself. Did you find
correct.
That happened to you as well?
Oh, absolutely.
How did you deal
yeah.
with that?
Well, you know, it's first of all, it's realizing as you work through the process what it is that you think you lost. And, you know, what we lost was our naivety. Because in my case, I knew Gary would never cheat. I just
mm-hmm.
knew it. Of course I knew it. And, mm-hmm. and, of course, I also knew Gary could never lie to me because he was such a terrible liar. And... In addition to that, I was so perceptive that if he did lie, I would, of course, know it. And so there was just no way it could ever happen. Well, when it happens, you lose all those preconceived notions. And for me, the other end of the spectrum was realizing that I never really did know. See, I just thought I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And all those people that sit there and look at you and say, oh, I know my husband or wife will never cheat, or I know I'll never cheat, hey, I've been doing this 12 years. I've yet to sit across from somebody that says, I always knew I would cheat and I planned on it. You know, that's not the way it typically happens. The only way I will know that Gary will never cheat again is to be attached to his hip 24/7. Well, that's not a healthy marriage. Now, what I do need, though, is to realize what trust really is and what trust really isn't. And trust is not knowing. Trust requires some vulnerability on my part. It's exposing my vulnerability to Gary. And I love the C.S. Lewis quote. Are you familiar with his quote from The Four Loves?
I think so. Go ahead.
Yeah. About the only place outside of heaven where you can be perfectly safe from all the dangers of love is hell. You know, so, I mean, if I divorce Gary because he cheated on me and marry somebody else, the reality is I'm not going to know if they're ever going to cheat either. I'm never going to know that. So part of that, Doug, is really realizing what I know and what I don't know. And differentiating that, because it's not that I've lost something that I had. I have lost something that I never really had in the first place. I just thought I had it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, was there any steps or process that you worked through in order to get that back, to get that trust back in yourself?
Yeah. Reality is that when you go through this trauma, you lose your safety.
Yeah.
And so the whole foundation of my life, what I thought made me safe in this world, no longer existed. So that had to be reestablished. In fact, our friend, have you talked with Rick Reynolds of the Affair Recovery Center?
No.
No.
Okay.
I'm familiar with
he's got some.
Great guy. Yeah,
he's got some awesome stuff. But anyway, he helped us understand that reestablishing that safety is really the precursor to trust.
Yeah.
Because saying, honey, I'll never do it again doesn't create safety.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be earned.
Yeah, he said you wouldn't do it in the first place.
Right.
Yeah.
So that takes both of you.
Yes, it does.
To recreate that safety. And as you process through the affair, As I can watch Gary process, just what happened?
Yeah.
How did he get there? What were those steps? Because the first step was not the first time they had sex or did something wrong or
right.
inappropriate. It was way back.
Yeah, I really, that was, I think, key to helping Mona to come to the realization that I was trying to change. Because one of the first things that I kind of came to in my process was I kind of adopted a little mantra, we're not going back. Not that what we had, and trying to negate the good things that we did have, we had, a good marriage. You know, so many people think that, you know, adultery only happens in bad marriages. That's not true. You know, we had a good marriage. I was just left extremely vulnerable. And how did I get there? And so I think it was very important for me to really, and not just me in my own soul searching, but me and Mona together as a couple, working on what left me vulnerable. When was that moment of truth? When did I cross the line? You know, and what did that line look like at that point? And as we processed through this together, she could hear what I was doing, and then I would begin to change my behavior, you know, to reflect that. And so when she could start to believe, it wasn't only me, Gary saying, well, I'm not going to cheat on you again. You know, I think it's important to say that, but I, like Mona said, you know, well, you said that before, so, you know, I mean, why
mm-hmm.
should I believe
yeah, it
now?
Really doesn't mean much, does it?
Right. So it was going to be her seeing different behaviors in me and seeing my desire to change, you know, that she could begin to believe in me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think that the onus is truly on the offending spouse to begin this process. They can't just come home and say, well, and I think it drives me crazy when counselors say, just forgive and forget, because then they adopt that and say, you need to just, you know, quit asking me mm-hmm. questions, you know, and they don't realize that they're just pushing this person in the shell and putting cement on top of them and saying, you know, stuff these emotions down and pray that one day they don't come back, because they usually do, and they manifest themselves
mm-hmm.
in a big way. But I mean, but the point I'm trying to make is the onus is here on, I think, on the offender to really try to create that process, peel that onion, really try to see that process. And then I say go one step further. And there are guys out there that say, what, are you crazy? Like for example, if you're watching a movie, I mean, you can't watch a movie because there's nothing on television that doesn't have something to do with infidelity. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. And there isn't.
Become so
yeah.
hyper aware of it. Mm-hmm. You'll turn on the TV and there's always something on. Well, mm-hmm. you know, I think the offenders have a tendency to say, "Oh boy, you know, let's hope this one flies over. Oh, don't want to say a word about that. Oh, you know." I say no. You say, "Is this bothering you? Is this something that do we need to turn the channel? Do we need to just turn this thing off? Do we need to talk about that?" Now I've had guys in group go, "What are you nuts?" You know, because you could take a night that was normally going along pretty well and nuke it. Okay, you could, but no, I believe that really fed Mona because mm-hmm. it even though it may nuke tonight may be destroyed, but a moment down the road, she's going to know that I cared enough about her
right.
to bring this up, and that mm-hmm. speaks to her hugely.
Right.
I'm feeding her. I'm behind her eyes. I'm feeling what she's feeling. And when you can do that, well, I think the offender can get truly behind the eyes of the spouse and truly feel with empathy what they've done, where they're at. It becomes a pivotal moment in the recovery mm-hmm. that you're both syncing up and you're on the same page. Now, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think
sure helps
that
it starts trust.
Yeah, I think that we lose that our spouse doesn't love us and doesn't care about us.
Right.
And for them to show some kind of sign mm-hmm. that they care about our feelings,
right, more
would
than
be amazing.
For their comfort.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that would show that would give some kind of security to
Absolutely.
What you're yep. doing.
It rebuilds that safety.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
The other component of this whole thing is consistency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've read, you know, how do you rebuild trust? You make and keep promises, make mm-hmm. and keep, make and keep, make and keep, because you've broken your vows. You've broken mm-hmm. those promises. And so that's why, as Gary said, the onus is on the person who is unfaithful, and they provide the opportunities. They hand the cell phone. See, I want you to look and see that I didn't contact this person today. Here's my mileage. Here's the password for all my computers, my Facebook. Here's where I was when I was 10 minutes late. I'm so sorry, or a phone call. And it's not that the unfaithful person is a 2-year-old that has to account to mommy for the rest of their life. What it is that they are taking advantage of every possible opportunity to prove to their husband or wife that they are trying their hardest to become trustworthy again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's huge. We use the illustration of, let's say I call Gary and say, can you pick up milk on your way home from work? Okay, sure. Well, he shows up after work without the milk.
Mm-hmm.
Well, suddenly it's no longer about the milk.
No,
it's
no.
about, well, see how untrustworthy you are?
Yeah, mm-hmm. really.
You know, and so it's about all, it, every little thing counts mm-hmm. during this rebuilding process.
Can I ask you, though, what do you do when the offended spouse isn't willing to do all these things?
You continue to help convey to them what the reality is of the healing process. This is where it's more than just you and your husband or wife sitting in the living room trying to heal. You need help. This is too huge.
Mm-hmm.
You need good counseling that understands the trauma and the process of healing. You need peer support, people like you guys, people like us. Gary can say things to that husband that he will never hear from his wife. He will never
That's
hear
true.
From me. But he can hear it from Gary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, that's the role we believe Hope and Healing plays. That's what happens in that weekend.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we were going through this, and the only person that Doug was talking to was the other woman, and it was like, if you could find a friend to talk to this about, a friend who has a good marriage, a friend that knows us, who can help you through this, you know, to hear from another man,
mm-hmm.
I think, speaks volumes.
But it has to be somebody, Linda, it has to be somebody that gets it.
Mm-hmm.
It
right.
has to be somebody,
yeah,
hopefully
I know.
Somebody
yeah.
who's been through it and healed. Because remember, we all thought this would never happen to us if we were good enough.
I know.
Gary never thought it would happen to him if he was a good enough man.
Nope.
I never thought it would happen to our marriage if I was a good enough wife. So when it's never happened to you, you can freak people out that have never been there because they're still living under that fallacy that it'll never happen to them because they're good enough.
Right. You know, I used to joke. I'd say, well, you know, I'll start resisting temptation the day it stops resisting me. You know, I didn't have a problem in this area. I never would have a problem in this area. There's no issues at all. And that right there was what left me so extremely vulnerable, you know. When we were doing that processing of going back through and seeing, you know, where was the line? Where was the... Mm-hmm. And I tell you what, I've got an acid test right now because you know, I obviously believe... Unless it's just like a one-night affair or one of those sex for sex sake kind of things. If it were something that I think, and this is what we see mostly in the Hope and Healing groups, is the fact that it's a progression, you know, it's a slow fade. It's something that, you know, you kind of fall into. And I can tell you, you know, because usually you go through the emotional affair stage and then into the physical affair. And the acid test is secrets. Do you have a secret? Do you have something with this quote-unquote friend of yours that you wouldn't want your wife or husband to know about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, did you discuss something at your lunch today because, well, you had to have lunch anyway. We got to eat, you know, and we have to talk about the client or whatever, you know, which is usually the work environment where these things all begin. And you see what I'm saying? If there's secrets involved, that's something. And that, to me, was where it began, when I had something with the other person that it kind of entered into my intimacy circle with Mona. You know, I mean, it was something that I had outside of that. And once you can kind of determine that, it's like you've gone too far. You know, you're into another relationship. And even though, and see, at that point, you can certainly see those things coming a mile away now. You know,
right, you were so aware of it now.
Right, these whistles and bells are going off, and so that's what Mona and I as a couple can create what we call hedges. You know, we create hedges around our relationship, and there are areas I can see that where I would be vulnerable, and it those we don't even give a chance, you know, at all. If anything of all even has a hint of that going on, it's immediately in the light. We talk about it immediately, and it's like, you know, and then once... I believe, and I've seen it over and over again, once you get something into the light, once you, as a couple, talk about it, just get it out in the open.
Honestly.
You know, I mean, just get it out in the open, it loses all of its power. It's not attractive any longer, you know. How beautiful or how good does that affair look when you really look at it in reality, you know, in the truth of the whole matter? It never would have grown legs and started running if it were would have been into the light.
Well, and you have to be willing to make changes, you
That's
know,
true.
Because part of the problem is we're sexual beings, and men and women are attracted to each other. That's not the problem. There will be women that Gary could be sexually attracted to for the rest of his life as long as he's breathing. What he needs to do now is to recognize when that's a woman he's sexually attracted to, and that's a clue. You avoid that woman. You don't start building a friendship and an intimate relationship. And by intimate, I don't mean sexual. I mean just intimate, where you're sharing your thoughts and feelings and hopes and dreams. You can't because it's too dangerous. That person needs to be avoided.
Yeah, and as a couple, you talk about it. I know that sounds crazy, but you would. You know,
well,
I have to feel that I can be comfortable enough to go to Mona, and Mona could be comfortable enough to come to me to say, you know what, I find that person kind of attractive, so, you know, if you know, come over and stand next to me in church if you see me talking to that person. Yeah, I know that sounds, it's an extreme, and it's like, well, come on. But really, that's how open Mona and I need to be with one another to absolutely build that hedge effectively. We have to be able to be honest with one another that way. So,
and I think, you know, unfortunately, you learn that after the affair.
Exactly.
That's correct.
Exactly.
Because every, you know, it's the Harry met Sally debate.
Yeah.
Men and women can be friends. But, you know, when you look at statistics, it's not worth the risk.
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. It really is after the affair. And any time a person before that, they just think, you know, you're overreacting. You're
overreacting, or there's nothing, or we're just friends.
And they'll play that justification game all the way down the path until it's way too late. But then that's when I always just look them square in the eye and say, you got secrets? You got secrets with that person? You don't want your wife or your husband to know about? And if they immediately look away and go, oh, well, you know, I don't think so. All you can do is point at it, you know, and just say, there you go. You know, I would strongly suggest that you, you know, think about this in a little bit different light, you know, because
mm-hmm.
you're on a pathway that could be really disastrous to your marriage. So.
It's amazing to me that now I see, like, in my work and everything, people
yep.
going down that path.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's so evident. And
every day.
Yep.
Yeah.
But Linda, really, if you stop and think about it, I think basically that's how we're wired as human beings. You know, I look back at Mona's and my situation. We were going 1,000,000 miles an hour, married 20 years, 3 active kids. The household mm-hmm. was going nuts. I'm building the business. She's crazy busy. And we didn't prioritize ourselves.
Right.
And our relationship was the bottom rung of both of your priority list.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, I mean, I remember, if you've read the book, one of the things that just kind of struck me was her saying, well, there'll be time for us later. And that
mm-hmm.
means, like, maybe when we're retired, we can, you know, go for a walk mm-hmm. or, you know, be friends again. You know, well, and it wasn't anything conscious to me, but it left me so extremely vulnerable when all of a sudden now I have met another person. I have no intention. I met this other person in church, for crying out loud, you know. And have no intention whatsoever to ever travel this pathway to infidelity, but that person is attracted to me, and I'm attracted to her, if I would really admit it deep down inside, and we become friends. And then now you've got a friend that's hanging on your every word, is affirming you emotionally, is affirming everything about you. Well, it's not that you're looking to destroy your relationship at home, but this person is hanging on your every word. That's very attractive. That's not a place you find yourself not going back to. And
right.
I think that's what begins the whole justification
mm-hmm.
stage all
mm-hmm.
on its own. You sit there mm-hmm. saying, this is no big deal. It's no big deal. Why? Because you want to be there. You want that person to like you and be attracted to you.
Mm-hmm.
And Lord knows you're not doing anything wrong. You know, I mean, we're not, you know, there's nothing physical going on. There's nothing, you know. But I'll tell you what, that's the whole thing. You just get closer and closer and
just,
closer and closer,
mm-hmm.
and the next thing you know, it's you start tripping over lines, and then it just becomes a full-blown affair, and
right.
it's a slow fade, but it happens over and over and over again, and we've just seen it all the time. So
mm-hmm. You do, and I think then you see the difference of what's happening at home. You know, your wife's too busy to hang on your every word, and then
right, exactly.
you start seeing that, you know, that person is perfect, and your wife is, you know,
yeah.
yeah.
Well, my wife really knows who I am.
Right.
There's no reason to hang on every word.
I'm
on punch.
No. Heard it all before.
The other side of that equation is adjusting your expectations. Because your affair partner always has time for you. Your affair
mm-hmm.
partner is always dressed and nice. I mean, and think about it. You make time. You plan. You shower. You wash your hair. You smile. You don't act out in frustration. You know, you kind of shove down any negatives because you want it to be fun. It's like dating.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of that is realizing that real life, real marriage, real love is composed of all of it, not just the fact. And that's why affairs are based on, they're not based on reality.
It's on
right.
yeah, unrealistic
expectations. It will never
yeah.
be that way. In fact, if Gary had divorced me and married his affair partner, they would have ended up having a very similar
mm-hmm.
relationship, and their chances of divorce are 75%.
Because there's so much
right.
baggage you're carrying around with you
right.
from that first
yeah.
one, you know? I mean,
yeah.
yeah, I think that it's that Hollywood, you know, that's another thing that is it just amazes me is this Hollywood expectation of love, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that we would all like love to have that, and I think we
mm-hmm.
all kind of go through that. But I mean, the scientists of brain chemistry, you know, when they do this that love rush that you get, you know, and all these, you know, these you know brain chemicals that are going on, the feel good, you know, the dopamines and all that sort of stuff, you know. And I'm no doc, but I've sat in enough you know conferences to make me dangerous. But what it does is that's a phase that we all go through, you know, and it only
biochemically.
Yeah, biochemically that we go through in that love romance stage, and it only lasts about 2 years, you know, 2 to 3 years. And then it just kind of progresses into that, you know, that relationship that goes on forever and ever, that best friends thing, that goes on. But those relationships that, you know, those emotions, those skyrockets, that everything that happens back in the early stages, I believe that that's what we believe is to be, that is love.
24/7.
Right. And so once you kind of process through this thing and 2-3 years later, you know, and these poor kids now, you know, these young kids that are married and they go, well, I don't have those feelings anymore. Well, it's like shoved down their throat that if you don't have these feelings, well, then you must not be in love anymore. So if you're not in love anymore, then you throw this marriage away and move on to the next one, you know, to try to maintain that kind of intensity in your relationship for the rest of your life. Unfortunately, what they don't really realize, you know, and this is me standing on my soapbox saying, you know, that, boy, hang in there, because the relationship you can have is just so much better than all that, you know, that intensity of the beginning. It can just be this awesome place that you can live for the rest of your life, you know, with this very cool person, you know, that totally knows everything about you and likes
and
you
and loves you. Yeah,
yeah,
loves you,
yeah,
for it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And accepts just, you for it.
Yeah.
And you can have those moments of romance. It's just not going to be 24/7.
Yeah.
Mona, I was wondering, I know Gary kind of just mentioned the word a little bit earlier about forgive, and we've discussed this a few times with some other experts and whatnot. In your opinion, and I guess in your situation, do you feel that you needed to forgive before you could trust?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, okay.
Yeah. And I think the problem is so many people confuse forgiveness and trust.
Really?
And in Christian circles and in secular circles. So we try to do this thing that is not forgiveness. Forgiveness is all, the focus is on the past. And I believe that forgiveness is a choice and a decision.
Sure.
It's me releasing Gary from the what he owes me. That I can say to him, you know, I use the example of you borrow my lawn. Well, here's example I use. You borrow my car, and I say, sure, you can borrow my fancy new sports car convertible and have a great day. Here's the keys. So he takes the car and drives it recklessly and does a little drinking, destroys the car. Fortunately, nobody's hurt, but the car is destroyed. Now, if I forgive him for destroying the car, then what that means in a practical sense is I'm not going to hold it against him for the rest of his life, and I can even release him from the debt. I can even say, you don't have to pay to replace my car. Okay, that's forgiveness. But when I get my new car, that does not mean that I'm going to hand him the keys and then put my kids in the back seat, because that's trust. So I can forgive without rebuilding trust or even reconciling. Take people who are abused, sexually abused, somebody whose house was robbed, whatever. You know, I'm never going to reconcile with that person. I might not even know who that person is. Or maybe that person dies before I can even get to a place of forgiveness. Not all forgiveness does not mean reconciliation, and it does not mean trust. It simply means that I have chosen to live with the consequences of that person's actions, whatever that looks like. That means for me, I got to fix that car. And I am not going to demand that they pay the penalty for it.
It's kind of releasing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
a
very good
story.
And
I think a real aha moment for forgiveness is the fact that you can choose to forgive person, but that doesn't negate the fact that you're still going to have emotional rush.
Right.
So many people think that like, you know, like, for example, Mona could have chosen to forgive me, and that's a decision that she's made to herself, but it doesn't have anything to do with her emotions, because And then I could sit back and just say, well, yeah, you've really forgiven me. You're screaming at me. You know? No, she can choose to forgive me, you know, to say, I know I choose to forgive you, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to have these, you know, this emotional rush, you know, that comes with that. You know, that's just because that's the processing of it all. You know,
that's, See, forgiveness is a decision, but it's also a process.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing process. Because I might, when I see that person who wrecked my car, I might have that rush of, doggone it, you wrecked my car. You know, that cost me. But as I'm working through those emotions and processing that, then I remind myself, no, I chose to forgive that.
Yeah.
And it's really between, forgiveness is really about me. Trust is about both of us.
Yeah.
Reconciliation is about both of us. But forgiveness is really about me because I either release that debt or I don't.
Right. And have you ever seen a person that can't forgive somebody? They're the ones that are in hell.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're destroying themselves, you know? I mean, it really is that bile, you know, that just that hatred that they have. They just can't forgive, and it's just a sickness that will eat them alive, you know? So it really is about forgiving to release yourself from that, too.
And I had to learn what forgiveness was. Forgiveness mm-hmm. was not saying that what happened was okay. It's not managing my emotions and pretending that it didn't hurt or it shouldn't hurt. It's not denying that anything wrong was done. It's certainly not an excuse. It's not saying, oh, okay, I get it. You had no other choice but to do what you did under the circumstances. Well, that's baloney. There is no good enough reason for some of the wrongs done to us, like abuse, like infidelity. And it's also not forgetting. It's not some kind of sentimental amnesia where you turn off your brain. So once I realized what forgiveness truly was, and then I could work on releasing that debt, you know, handing, in my case as a believer, it involves me handing over to God the responsibility for justice, that I can release my need. We all want justice. There's something innate in us that wants justice. And I love what Rick Reynolds says, too, is that forgiveness means giving up all hope of ever having a better past. When I first heard that, I went, what do you mean giving up all hope? That doesn't sound right at all. But then I had to listen to what they were saying. It was all hope of ever having a better past. Because for me, it would never be okay unless it went away. Well, that's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
I had to come to a point where I realized and accepted that as much as it was wrong, as much as I didn't like it, as much damage as had been done. It was part of my past. But it didn't have to determine my future.
Right.
Did you think that accepting was very difficult?
Obsessing?
Accepting it. Accepting
oh,
it.
Oh, hugely difficult.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Hugely.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the final pieces of the puzzle. Just
is
like
it?
I believe trust is one of the final pieces of the puzzle. Because none of us want to accept this.
Right.
No, this is not what we envisioned. You know, someone who's abused doesn't want to accept this. The people at 911 never want to accept that they had to go through that. No, accepting is huge, and it's just part of the process. You can't make somebody go there. You can't rush them through the process, and you certainly can't demand that they quit working through the process. That's why our saying for couples is, it's over when you both say it over and not a minute before.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care how long it takes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think then that it just takes time to accept it?
Yeah.
I mean, is there?
Yeah. But again, and a therapist friend of ours says this, it's not time that heals. It's how you spend that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What you do to move in that direction.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you know, Linda, too, one thing I have found over and over and over and over again, anybody that's ever come to the point of acceptance, it's always, always in hindsight. You will you'll never see it coming.
Right.
It's just something that one day you wake up and go, oh, wow, we have made it through this, haven't we? We have, haven't we? It's always hindsight. So I think
a lot of the things are in hindsight.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. And I don't know if you've read Janice Abrams' spring book on forgiving, But, you know, she divides forgiving into forgiving and acceptance. And, you know, that's part of it. That really mm-hmm. is part of it. So,
I think you think you don't realize you're going through the stages. And then when you have arrived, you look back and say, oh, now I know how I got there.
Right.
And what it feels like to be
right
that way.
Right. Because it's never going to be okay. See, that's the problem. And so many of us say, well, if I accept it, I'm saying it was okay. No, you're not. You're just accepting the reality of what happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it stinks.
That's right. That's right. And they say, well, I hurt like this forever. You know, that's what I use the analogy of, like a scar. You know, you have a scar. Yeah. It hurt like the devil when you dropped your, you know, the chainsaw on your arm. You know, but
it took years to heal
and it hurt like the dickens. But, you know, I can look back at it and when I may be reminded of that scar, but it really doesn't hurt anymore. So it just mm-hmm. becomes like a sad memory. You know, it's just like, mm-hmm. yeah, well, that's the way it was. You know, I mean, it's never going to not be that because you have to accept that past. But mm-hmm.
And you can focus on it if you want to.
Yeah, if you want to, but why, you know? Yeah, why?
Yeah. Right. But I think you have to make that conscious effort not to.
Amen.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is an individual work. Mm-hmm. There is no way that Gary could make me do that.
That's mm-hmm. right.
But he could help me walk through the process. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He could help me heal by doing his part.
Right.
And that'll sure make it easier for me to forgive, and it'll make mm-hmm. it easier for me to accept. But it's my work.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's the misconception, is there's so many things that we both needed to do individually.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In the meantime, we could work together on things, but I think there, you know, you had to do both parts.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
It couldn't be a joint effort, and it couldn't just be by yourself. You had to do it.
Exactly. Right. It's so convoluted. That's why most of us need help to get through this.
Well, mm-hmm. yeah, and it really is a couple's journey. You know, I mean, it is something you both have to end up buying into and both feed that couple, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, you both, because, you know, there are days that maybe I didn't want to work, you know, and for me, I wouldn't, because I just soon forget it today, and that particular day, I may be totally hacked at Mona because she did or said something that was just, you know, mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
And so to work for her, I wouldn't want to do it, you know, because, you know, I mean, if I'm truly being honest with myself, it's like, hey, you're the one that just, you know, put gravel in my pancakes or whatever, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? And it's mm-hmm. stupid analogy, but you know what I'm saying. But still, to feed us, I would be willing to go that extra mile because mm-hmm. I knew that was in the best interest of us as a couple, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, I think that's an important thing. But you're right, it is a couple's journey. And that's why forgive and move on will never work. It just can't work. Not really and truly build that level of intimacy again. You know, I believe, because you can't take all those emotions and just put a lid on them and just mm-hmm. forget that they're there. They need to be taken out of the can and looked at and truly processed as a couple. Yeah.
Do you, when you're in the initial stages of this, do you let the couples know how difficult this is going to be?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Okay, she's saying, in the initial stages when we're talking to couples, do we let them know how difficult this is going to be?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We're honest. But we try to be honest where they can handle it.
Yeah.
You know, if they're still in that initial shock with that flat affect or their anger is raging out of control, you have to meet them where they are.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely try to educate and normalize. But you can't do it all at once.
No. Yeah. But, you know, we don't ever sugarcoat it because this is a process, and we believe mm-hmm. that it's absolutely worth going through the process, you know, to where they can come out at the other end. Because we've had just so many couples that, you know, I mean, the best one I ever heard was a guy who said, I would never have chosen the path to get to where we are today, but I would never trade for where we are today for anything mm-hmm. in this world. And that's true. That's what happens. I believe that if you process through the adultery, you can have a relationship that's just stellar. And so many people don't believe that. And I think that's where couples like us need to stand on our soapbox and go, you guys, it's not the death sentence to the marriage. It's not. It can be, you can get through this, but it's not, it's hard. It really
is.
Yeah,
I think that's the problem is they're looking for an easy way out.
Yeah,
and,
right. There's no silver bullet in this one. No.
No.
Because everybody's different, you know, and they're all going to have their own issues. And you know, and what an awesome time to deal with the issues of the marriage when God's got your attention, you know. You know what I mean? I mean, when you're going through adultery recovery, to not use that time to work on the marriage issues, I think is crazy. You need to do that, just because, even though I think that there comes a time for that, you know, I mean, where, because I think it can become a, you mean to tell me you went out and had an affair because, you know, I don't make eggs sunny side up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Obviously, you can't do that. But I think that it is an awesome time to really peel the onion on your relationship as well as the infidelity.
Mm-hmm. We encourage couples to separate it. It's two, at least this helped me. It's two issues. One's the infidelity.
Mm-hmm.
The infidelity was the unilateral choice that Gary made. There is no reason good enough. I don't care if I was the worst wife in the world. He had just as much responsibility to come to me and say, hey, you're the worst wife in the world. You need help. You know, he chose to deal with whatever circumstances were or were not going on in the marriage. He chose to deal with them by having an affair to make himself feel better. So I have no responsibility for his choice of infidelity. However, he brought it home. Guess what? Now we have to deal with it because it damaged our relationship.
Right.
But the second issue is the marriage itself. Now that's where we have 50-50 responsibility. And like Gary said, this is an opportunity to examine that. Most of us find that there were some serious deficits in the marriage.
Right.
Sometimes not, but that's pretty rare. And so, you know, for us, we found some things that were unacceptable. Gary felt unloved and unwanted in our marriage. Not something I ever intended to communicate to him, but he felt it. So we had to figure out how did that happen and how are we going to live in the future. Now
I can assure you I did not come home the first night with my infidelity and say, you know, I felt unloved and unwanted.
Loved and unwanted.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. After the knives in the knife drawer would have been thrown at me, you know, she'd probably been looking for the shotgun.
Right. And again, that's part of that processing,
exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
But what we found out as we processed through was we needed to make some changes in some things. Some things were, again, those unrealistic expectations. You know, Gary was never supposed to be everything to me, nor was I supposed to be everything for him. Some of it was just plain selfish, and we had to let it go. Some of it was just petty and don't, you know, like the toilet seat. My gosh, there are so many things to argue about. So what if I'm hacked off every time I find the toilet seat up? I can be hacked off for 30 seconds, put it down, and move on. I mean, it's just not worth it. But only the couple can decide what issues fall in what category.
You'd be angry for 30 seconds over that?
Well, some people are, Derek.
I
can care less.
A whole 30 seconds.
Well, Gary and Mona, we're getting kind of close on our end of our time here, but I did want to ask one further question that we've really been kind of asking of everybody we talk to here, and that is that we get comments and emails from people on our blog, you know, all the time, continuously, and many of them state that even though the cheating spouse is doing everything they possibly can, they're being transparent, they're acting in a trustworthy manner, you know, et cetera, they just don't feel that they can ever trust their partner again. You know,
right.
What do you have to say to these types of, you know, in these types of situations? What do you say to them?
Well, I go back to what I believe rebuilds trust, and that is that safety part of it. It's that consistency, and there's also another part of it, and that is that it does require a person to be vulnerable. When Gary has done everything he can to prove that he's doing his best to be trustworthy, there comes a point where I have to become vulnerable to him if we're ever going to trust again. Now, I have to extend that same safety to him, that his efforts are being recognized and that he's safe when he comes and speaks truth to me. Now, that usually is going to happen in small baby steps. It's testing the safety. It's extremely difficult after a betrayal. But if you're going to rebuild trust, it's absolutely required. Because rebuilding trust is both of you. One person cannot rebuild trust alone.
That's
So I am going to have to be vulnerable, and I am going to have to take a risk. Now, I can do it in an educated way. I don't have to be an idiot. If he has not proven himself trustworthy again, you know, so my first question is, they've done everything. Well, what does that look like? You know, have they really? But if they come back and say, well, they'll never talk to me about it. They just blow me off. They won't answer my questions, or they get mad at me. They don't keep their promises about bringing the milk home. I catch them in lies. Well, then they're not doing their part, and they haven't done it.
Yeah.
But if they truly have done it, and none of us are going to be perfect in this. That's the problem. The person who was unfaithful is not going to be perfect, and the person who didn't have the affair isn't going to be perfect. But that's where the vulnerability comes in. And I can do that. I can take that step forward. When Gary and I have processed through the infidelity, and he's really taken a look at how he got there, I see him process that. And I know that in the future, whenever he meets a woman that he's sexually attracted to, he's not going to spend time with her. He's not going to excuse a lunch. He's going to prevent anything from happening, because his hedges, boundaries are going to be way back before anything can happen. And that's what's required there, Doug, I believe.
Okay, let me jump in here too, because can they ever trust again? I think that's usually a question that comes from someone that's earlier in the stages, somebody that is beginning the process and is trying to do everything that they can. And I think that everything that Mona says, I can only echo that. But I think that what it is as you process through this, and as you continue down the path together, you begin to trust in little micro baby steps.
Exactly.
And those things compile. And it takes a while for that to become something that you can truly wrap your brain around as the offended spouse. And I think that's something that is just going to take a while to get through, mm-hmm. and to not lose hope of the fact that there are I would say millions of couples. Well, I don't know how many, because nobody, who's got the numbers?
Right,
but, I mean,
right.
There are couples out there, I can say for sure, hundreds and hundreds of couples that we have seen that have come through this that trust again. Mm-hmm. So you just have to know that you're going to be able to trust again. And that's extremely important to realize that this is a process that happens over a period of time, and that you will just eventually get to that point. I think it's very important for the offended or the offending spouse to be very open and transparent, and when it does get frustrating, to still be open and transparent with those feelings as well, without getting angry and causing it to escalate. I think it's really important that you both work on it from behind each other's eyes. Seriously, I keep going back to that, because I think it's so important that you have empathy, not only that the offended spouse or the offending spouse have empathy of the offended, but vice versa. I think you both really need to be able to get behind each other's eyes and see the process that you're coming through together. And then over a period of time, as you begin to trust again, it'll just compile. And then eventually, in hindsight, you'll look back and go, wow, I do trust you, because I am willing to be vulnerable again.
Let me share a story with you guys, because we believe that this illustrates the point. And this is one of our facilitating couples. It's a very true story. His affair went on for years, and there was a huge healing process, and very slowly done. But 2 years after revelation, after the affair had ceased and he had no contact with the other woman, it was his birthday, and he was delivered at his office on his birthday a bouquet with a card signed by the other woman. Made him angry. He wanted to throw him in the garbage, and but he was faced with a choice, because everyone in the office assumed that the flowers were from his wife. And so he couldn't throw them away in the office, because then they'd wonder why. And he thought, well, I'll just pretend this never happened. But then, there was that little voice in the back. What if somebody tells her how pretty the flowers were she sent? So on his way home, he threw the flowers off a bridge into the river, and he walked into the house on his birthday and told his wife what had happened. Now, he ruined his birthday. It upset his wife greatly. They did not have a fun evening. He did not have a fun birthday. But don't you know that what he did that day put a huge trust coin in the bank?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because to this day, she talks about that, saying that, well, Dan came home and ruined the night. There's no doubt about it.
We didn't say a name.
I'm sorry. I didn't say a name. Came home and ruined the night. But, hey, you know what? To this day, she can point to that and say, you know, that I can trust this man because, you know, this is different. This is not what he would have done before. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And anything different. And I think so often after the affair is over and they think the affair is over and if there is contact,
right,
they're so afraid to bring it up, where it's so important to know
that
they brought it up.
Right.
They told you about it and they were honest.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's part of that safety that you extend to the spouse who was unfaithful, that they can come home, and even if you have an emotional response, mm-hmm. which she did that night, that you'll get past that, and you can mm-hmm. recognize what did and didn't happen.
Yeah. I think it's true that you brought that up, a good point to help with couples, is to have a game plan.
Yeah.
You know, that if, what if this other person reaches out? What if you run into this person at the grocery store? What if you see him at work? What are we, quote-unquote, we, as a couple, going to do about that?
Mm-hmm.
You
know, how are we going to handle it?
How are we going to handle? How will this? Right. You know, and that would be something that I would ask Mona. Mona, how you know, what do you, what would make you feel comfortable? I know there's nothing that's going to make you feel comfortable about what happens, but what do you think I should do? Let's talk about what I should do, and then together we can noodle this as a plan. You know, and then I know exactly what would feed her if this were to ever happen,
mm-hmm.
and then. When it does happen, and I'm not going to say if, because doggone it, it's usually when, this does occur, then you don't pass go. You do not collect $200. You go right home and say, well, it happened. Now, yeah, did it nuke the night? Probably so. But I stuck to the plan. We stuck to the plan, and it fed the couple. It fed mm-hmm. Mona and I. And
mm-hmm.
then so even though it hurt, and even though she's crying about it, I am Superman, you know, in a way, for trust, mm-hmm. you know, for down the road trust,
right. mm-hmm.
you know, she's now, I'm bringing everything into the light. So
right. And you're united too.
Yeah, that's right. And, but she has to be careful too, that what?
Yeah.
What
her reaction's going to be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because remember, if she were to do that every time I were to come home with the honesty, then it just teaches me to not come home with the honesty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why should I do that if she's going to attack me every time? So it really is a two-way street, this recovery.
And the other thing I encourage, when we encourage couples to talk about it. You know, so many times people do continue to work together, and that's extremely difficult. Well, if the betrayed spouse is sitting there saying, well, you just never talk to them. Never, ever. I don't care what happens. Well, that's not realistic.
No.
Mm-hmm.
So the plan has to be something that works. Because if you demand something that won't work, if you have agreed that this person is going to continue working because you have to make a house payment and feed your kids, then the reality is that there will be some sort of politeness when they see this person. And then, you know, they can choose to walk away if it ever gets personal. But it has to be a plan that'll work. Mm-hmm. And there's been some creative plans out there.
Mm-hmm.
But doing it together is the key.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. It is. That you're together on this rather than apart. And that's how
right.
the affair began in the first place.
That's right.
Exactly.
You start to feed the secrets again. And that you
right.
can't do that. No. You have to keep it in the light.
Well, Gary and Mona, this has been a really wonderful conversation mm-hmm. with you guys. We really appreciate it. You've given us a lot of great information to pass along to people, and we do really appreciate it very much. And I'm glad you could spend the time with us today.
Well, thank you for having
really.
Us. Really. You know, our goal is just to
help couples
yeah. and get them through, and really, like Gary said, if those of us who have been through it don't help educate and normalize, who's going to?
That's right. It really, you know, right. it is not the death sentence to their marriage. Boy, scream that from the rooftop. It is not. They can have an awesome relationship.
Yep, that is true. Well, thanks again. And once again, for everybody that's listening, Gary and Mona's site is hopeandhealing.us. Certainly visit their site and consider the programs and their books and things like that. And they have a lot of great information to share. So, Gary and Mona, thank you so much again. And
thank you.
Wonderful day, and I hope maybe we can do this again sometime.
Hey, man, we're here. You know where we are.
It was nice to meet you both.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice to meet you, too. Thanks.
Okay, God bless.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.